I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
They're checking all your bags and everything like that. It's harder to get in and come out because they actually check you sometimes when you come out, too.
A worker at the World Bank headquarters in New York City reacting today to increased security after yesterday's announcement that terrorists are targeting major financial centers in the Northeast United States. Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge announced terrorists may target buildings in New York, Newark, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., perhaps planning attacks with car or truck bombs. We'll have more on the intelligence leading to the announcement in a moment, but first, how are the cities reacting? Joining us on the line from New York is Alexandra Marks of the Christian Science Monitor. Alexandra, what extra security measures did you see around New York today?
Well, they're mostly concentrated down in the Wall Street area. Investment bankers and traders were greeted by guys carrying, police officers carrying semi-automatic weapons. There are a lot more bomb-sniffing dogs, The police presence is pretty evident, and according to one of our interns that was down there, so is the media presence. So suddenly there's a lot of attention down in that area. But New York has been on high alert since 9/11, so on some level, we're also just taking it in stride.
But there were some companies in particular that were named in each of the cities. Which are they in New York, and how are they reacting there?
Citicorp is one in particular, and one of our reporters was chatting with somebody who was having his morning cigarette break outside, and he was just absolutely calm, taking it in stride. Clearly, there's a sense of tension in those companies in particular. People are, their own security agencies are geared up. But again, this is something that we've become very accustomed to in New York.
Well, how are New Yorkers reacting to the ideas that we've heard that Al-Qaeda operatives might have infiltrated the buildings, made friends with security guards, acted as couriers? We just have a couple seconds, but how are they responding to that?
Nobody wants to let the terrorists change the way we behave, and nobody. So it is very disturbing that it's gotten that far. But there's also another sense of confidence, or they feel a little better that at least that our intelligence agencies were able to pick up on this before the actual attack.
And finally, Alexandra, the Statue of Liberty, the interior is expected to reopen tomorrow. Well, was is that going to go ahead as planned?
Going ahead as planned. There's a real sense that that the opening of the Statue of Liberty is indicative of kind of a defiance against terrorism. That it's a defiance. We're going to have our public spaces. We're going to do this. Although the security is very, very tight, and kids can no longer crawl to the top and look out the face and those wonderful winding stairs. You can't go into the statue anymore. You're just into the base, and that's kind of a loss. But it's a trade-off in this world.
Alexandra Marks, thank you. Alexandra is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from New York. And we turn now to Washington, D.C., where New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau is covering security. Eric, what do you see any different in the Capitol today?
Well, there's certainly a sense of urgency that we didn't see just a couple of days ago. I think everyone is on guard, certainly, especially around the IMF and the World Bank. And people are looking both at the security measures and intelligence to find out exactly what this is about.
The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, two of the biggest employers in D.C., over 10,000 people and two blocks from the White House?
Right.
What are you seeing at those buildings in particular?
Well, there's certainly a much more visible security presence, both in terms of private security and of homeland security. And there's been extensive discussion back and forth between the Department of Homeland Security and the IMF, the World Bank, and the sites in Manhattan and New Jersey that were cited.
We're going to talk about the intelligence leading up to this alert in just a moment, but how are people reacting to some of what we're hearing, that in fact these operatives have been there for years, perhaps before 9/11, that some of this information was known prior to this past weekend? Are they taking they've been raised to an orange alert level in these cities and around these institutions. Are they taking it seriously?
Yeah, I think most people are certainly taking it seriously. When the administration has put out warnings like this in the past, there has been some skepticism from Democrats that was being used for political purposes, that perhaps the threat was being exaggerated. We haven't really heard that as much the last day, I think because of how specific a lot of this intelligence was, especially in terms of these reconnaissance missions. It's difficult to, at least publicly, for people to question, this may be hyped in some way.
Yeah. Eric, I'm going to switch gears on you for just a second, if you don't mind, and ask, as we prepare to talk more about the intelligence, What do we know about how much of an increase in intelligence there was over this past weekend?
Well, we certainly know that on Friday the U.S. got what was described as a treasure trove of documentary evidence, we believe, from Pakistan through the arrest of a suspected al-Qaeda operative there, a computer engineer. And from what we understand, it was a detailed description of security measures that were taken and reconnaissance missions in terms of casing out several of the sites that were mentioned by Secretary Ridge. This was documentation that was much more detailed than the CIA has seen in the past.
Do you have a sense of what it was like in Washington? We're hearing one source told reporters that the weekend was a nail biter.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think certainly beginning on Friday, probably around noontime, at most of the intelligence agencies, there was kind of a mad dash to look at this and find out the sourcing and the credibility of it before they made the decision late on Saturday to go to the orange alert in the affected areas.
Can you tell us more about what was discovered over the weekend? We hear about blueprints and CDs. What was on them?
Well, it was, from what we understand, a lot of detail about the measures that had been taken in terms of finding out everything from how many guards are on duty, what time they change schedules, what color uniforms they're wearing, to local coffee shops where you could take cover, escape routes, and things like that. Eye-opening material that indicated that al-Qaeda had, for several years now, been undertaking surveillance missions. That's the administration's description of the documentation.
Yeah. Can you tell us more? You mentioned the one arrest on Friday, or the one acknowledgement of an arrest on Friday, but there were two arrests that seem to have provided the most information. Can you tell us more about those two operatives? Alleged
right.
operatives, I should say.
Right. Our understanding is that that these were al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan, one of whom was a computer engineer who may have been involved in as kind of a communications guru for al-Qaeda allowing them to send emails that could not easily be diagnosed by U.S. intelligence.
And we understand, too, that one of the operatives, at least, is said to belong to a new al-Qaeda. What does that mean?
Well, I think what the intelligence community has been seeing the last few years al-Qaeda kind of recreating itself in different forms. As much as 70% of al-Qaeda's leadership in 9/11 is now thought to be dead, and that has resulted in new versions of the group kind of reinventing themselves throughout al-Qaeda's strongholds.
And just one last thought before we let you go, Eric. We're hearing words like excruciating detail and chilling, the extent to which the operatives were in these different buildings.
Right. I think most people who heard the description of these reconnaissance missions were struck by how detailed they were. There were anywhere from probably 25 to 30 different points of information that they seem to have focused in on. As I mentioned, everything from security procedures to what days the elevators were running to where the local police departments and hospitals were. I mean, this seemed to be a meticulous surveillance of these sites for purposes of determining their vulnerabilities.
Eric Lischbach, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Eric covers Washington for the New York Times. Well, that's the sound of the opening bell on Wall Street today, where it's business as usual, despite the fact that financial institutions were specifically identified as targets in a possible terrorist attack. To find out what impact, if any, this is having on the stock market, we turn now to Marcia Vickers, senior writer for Business Week. Marcia, how did the market take the news?
Well, you know, April, it was, earlier today, it was not doing well. It did swoon a bit, but surprisingly enough, the Dow is now up 7 or 8 points. So you've got to look at the market and say that it's taking its stride right now, basically, and that, really, this is really detailed information that we've gotten, and I think it shocked a lot of people. On the other hand, since 9/11, 3 years ago, I think Wall Street has sort of been, on edge as it is and bolstered itself in terms of security. And so the market itself kind of looks like this is oh, gosh, yet another terrorist threat. But it doesn't seem to have been really hit by that information, as one might suspect it might be.
Well, are there sectors that are more vulnerable?
Well, certainly. You know, I was just checking some of the stocks that were actually named in this report, and you've got Prudential and Citigroup and, you know, obviously the financials. And they're down a bit today and actually have rebounded also a bit from earlier today. And really, the other stocks have not done so badly. And again, the Dow is up right now. So I think, what you see is since 9/11, the terrorist threats have been priced into the market. Now, that doesn't mean that if something were to actually happen, the market wouldn't crater. It probably would. There's almost no doubt that it would. But really, we've almost become sort of immune to it, despite the fact that this is particularly, you hear the details of this is particularly chilling. I think Wall Street is sort of trying very hard to see this as business as usual, and the market itself is kind of going on as it would normally. And I think that's actually a very good sign.
We say that it's going on as normal, but are there other repercussions? And you hesitate to raise the question, although others have. What about the politics of all of this and the politics of the constant alerts, in this case, the more serious alert? How is that affecting Wall Street, do you see?
Well, I think it's just, the market has jitters just in general. And I think if you just focus in on the terrorist bit, that's going to be difficult to pinpoint. Wall Street is now not just New York anymore, as you know. It's really global. I mean, it's especially it's spread out all around America. So it's certainly not just Wall Street when you look at the stock market. So what we're looking at, is the New York Stock Exchange today and Prudential and Citigroup and all coming out with statements and press releases and press conferences and saying that they've bolstered their security. So really, you're sort of looking at two different things. I think the market itself it's got a lot of things weighing on it right now.
Well, just
terrorism,
a quick,
obviously is a factor.
A quick question, Marcia, because we just have a couple of seconds. I meant as
sure.
Well, do you see, big business is usually seen as favoring the Republican candidate or President Bush in this case. How do you see it being impacted by terrorism? And we just have a few seconds.
Big business is trying to go on business as usual again. I really think that everybody is sort of, since 9/11, been concerned about it. I don't think it's big business is necessarily going to favor Republicans versus the Democrats over the issue of terrorism. I think there are other issues, the trade deficit, just the deficit in general, the budget deficit. All of that are weighing on business people, their minds right now in terms of the election. And, of course, now that Kerry and Edwards seem a strong team and there are these issues with the deficit and other things, that people are sort of, the business people are sort of looking at them and saying, well, gosh, they're a possibility now. And so that itself is overhanging the market right now, the election in the sense that Bush isn't a shoe-in anymore.
Marcia Vickers.
Certainty.
Marcia Vickers, thank you so much. Marcia Vickers, senior writer for Business Week magazine. Next up, John Kerry's the candidate, first one since 72, whose ratings didn't rise after the convention. What happened? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this news note. In a Rose Garden press conference this morning, President Bush announced his support of two recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission, the creation of a National Counterterrorism Center and a National Intelligence Director. But he said he would keep the new position out of the White House.
Today I'm asking Congress to create the position of a National Intelligence Director. The person in that office will be appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate, and will serve at the pleasure of the President. The National Intelligence Director will serve as the President's principal intelligence advisor and will oversee and coordinate the foreign and domestic activities of the intelligence community. Under this reorganization, the CIA will be managed by a separate director. The National Intelligence Director will assume the broader responsibility of leading the intelligence community across our government.
President Bush also promised to create a new agency to better coordinate intelligence information.
Today I also announced that we will establish a National Counterterrorism Center. This new center will build on the analytical work, the really good analytical work, of the Terrorist Threat Integration Center and will become our government's knowledge bank for information about known and suspected terrorists. The new center will coordinate and monitor counterterrorism plans and activities of all government agencies and departments to ensure effective joint action and that our efforts are unified in priority and purpose. The center will also be responsible for preparing the daily terrorism threat report for the president and senior officials. The director of the National Counterterrorism Center will report to the National Intelligence Director once that position is created. Until then, the center will report to the director of the CIA.
President Bush in the Rose Garden this morning. The president says he'll follow through on more 9/11 Commission recommendations in the next few days. The pharmaceutical giant Merck sells about $2.5 billion worth of Vioxx every year. It's a blockbuster drug, but is it safe? Vioxx is one of a relatively new class of painkillers. The company markets it as a one pill a day for relief of arthritis pain. But Vioxx has also been linked to serious heart problems. Our regular health columnist Judy Foreman visited us in the studio last week. I asked her, how big is the market for Vioxx?
Well, I mean, just people with arthritis, that's 22 million Americans, and people without arthritis but have with other pain problems are taking it. So these drugs are a huge market, and they've been hyped enormously, hundreds of millions of dollars a year in advertising.
And we've seen the advertising for it.
We've seen the ads, and, you know, they're very clever. They don't promise the moon, but they sort of suggest that your whole life is going to change with these drugs.
Briefly, how does it work to help people?
Okay, pain and inflammation together are actually caused by chemicals that your body makes called prostaglandins. And the thing that controls prostaglandins are these two enzymes called COX-1 and COX-2, or cyclooxygenase. COX-1 is basically good. It makes good prostaglandins that protect your stomach. COX-2 is bad. It makes harmful prostaglandins that drive inflammation and pain. So the whole goal with these new drugs called COX-2 inhibitors is to get the good stuff without the bad stuff, to protect your stomach, but also control the pain.
What are some of the others in the same class?
In the same class is Celebrex, which a lot of people take, and a couple of lesser-known drugs called Bextra and Mobic.
Okay. Now, there have been some problems associated with Vioxx. What are those problems?
Well, the chief problem that has really scared people was a total surprise, and it's an increase in heart disease. In one study, there was 2 to 4 times the risk compared to a traditional NSAID, which is the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen. In this case, it was prescription-strength Aleve. So that came as a surprise. Nobody was expecting that Vioxx would be linked to heart problems. But a number of studies in the last 2 or 3 years have actually confirmed that link. The doses of Vioxx that have been shown to be dangerous for your heart are like 50 milligrams a day. And that's so the recommendation is that you not take that high a dose for more than a week or so. And the biggest risk of taking Vioxx is in the first 90 days. So basically, if you stick to the lower doses, you'll probably be all right. So you should definitely talk to your doctor about doses.
And do that anyway. Well, how is the industry responding to this? I mean, what about the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, the FDA actually sent a warning letter to Merck a couple of years ago for alleging that they were doing false advertising of Vioxx because they were making such inflated claims and the data was coming in that actually there were some dangers associated with Vioxx.
And consumers?
And consumers are quite mixed. There's some lawsuits. Several different kinds of lawsuits. Shareholders complaining that they were misled into buying stock for a drug that wasn't living up to its potential. And a number of personal injury cases in New Jersey and California, at least 100 cases in each of those states. So there's starting to be a backlash.
Well, were any of the other COX-2 inhibitors, such as Celebrex, also linked to heart problems?
Not so far. That's a great question. And nobody really understands why Vioxx would do it and Celebrex would not. They're chemically so similar that you would think if Vioxx was dangerous, Celebrex would be too. But so far, that hasn't been shown.
Well, you know, while we're on the topic, there is another consideration with these COX-2 inhibitors. They're really far more expensive than, let's say, ibuprofen.
Yes, by a mile. I actually called CVS, and a month's supply of ibuprofen for someone with arthritis at the doses they would be taking costs about $18. And for Vioxx and Celebrex, it's over $100 each.
Right. So what are people saying? Is it worth that much more money?
Well, the drug companies would say yes, but I think a lot of analysts would say no. And particularly, not just is the risk higher with Vioxx and the cost, but there's no clear evidence that these drugs work that much better at controlling the pain.
So is Vioxx any better for your stomach than the less expensive alternatives?
If you're somebody who's had a lot of trouble already with bleeding ulcers or you're at high risk for that, some doctors would say, yes, you're probably better off taking Vioxx. But for most people, it seems to be a very expensive drug that may not be a whole lot better than the standard stuff.
Well, Judy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Here Now's regular health columnist Judy Foreman. To read more of her column on this issue, visit our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, making your own arrangements for the dearly departed. We'll learn about the home funeral movement. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's no surprise that John Kerry and John Edwards are campaigning in battleground states today. But what is surprising to many is a new poll that shows Kerry didn't even get a little bounce coming out of last week's nomination convention. In fact, he may have lost ground, the first time that's happened to a candidate since 1972. The USA Today CNN Gallup poll shows that Bush now leads Kerry 50% to 46% among likely voters. The numbers are nuanced and more are on the way. But to take a look at them, we are joined on the line by two Beltway veterans. Carl Lubsdorf is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Robin.
And Andrea Stone, Washington reporter for USA Today.
Hi, Robin.
And Andrea, to you first. In your poll, in the USA Today poll, Kerry did better with registered voters than he did with likely voters. What does that mean?
Well, he also did better just among national adults. And the only area where he didn't do well was among likely voters. And I'm not sure, maybe Carl has been watching polls a lot longer than I have, why that the nuance between those two.
Well, let's find out, Carl, because we understand that registered voters are those who say they are registered. Likely are probably those who are saying they're registered and they're going to vote. But what does it mean that there's a difference between the response?
Well, all pollsters screen their call. You know, once they make their calls, they try to create a model of what they believe the electorate will be, and they have their methods for determining what a likely voter is beyond that someone is registered. And usually in most elections, the likely voter sample is a little more Republican than the Democratic, than the registered voter sample.
Well, that might point out
Republicans tend to be higher income, higher educated in general, and they tend to vote more. Now, there's been a lot of speculation this year that, of course, that wouldn't be true, that there's such anger among many Democrats at President Bush that, in fact, the likely voters wouldn't skew slightly Republican in this poll, and I'm not familiar with the details of how the poll is done.
Well, we're going to take a look at some of the other results, and we'll just go with the likely voter response, Andrea. So let's take a look. While, as we mentioned, Kerry lost ground to Bush overall, respondents said Kerry could better handle the situation in Iraq, 54-43, mm-hmm. and that Bush could better handle terrorism, 54-42. But when asked who could be trusted to handle the role of commander-in-chief of the military, respondents picked Kerry over Bush, 51-46%.
Yeah, there's a lot of good news in this poll for John Kerry. I wouldn't, if I were his campaign, I wouldn't be totally depressed, even though the top line doesn't look that good for him. But, you know, our poll also showed that 26% rated his speech on Thursday night as excellent, which was a more positive response than Bush got in 2000. And, you know, people really, the whole military service, which all we heard ad nauseum at the convention last week, it seemed to have sunk in because a 52% majority said that they thought Kerry's service in Vietnam would help him become a more effective president. So that obviously helped him there. So I think they are getting some of their message across. But I also think there's probably some reasons why we didn't see as big a bounce out of this poll as we have seen in previous campaigns. I think one reason is because people are so much more engaged. I mean, it's only August, and people are much more engaged. Usually they don't even tune in until Labor Day. The country is 50-50, as we've heard. Most people have made up their minds. So the people who we're really talking about is maybe 10-15% of the so-called swing voters. So most people are sort of dug in their heels already. And one other thing I might mention is that, you know, at a lot of conventions, we don't learn about the vice presidential pick until just right before or at the convention. We've known for 3 weeks now that John Edwards was the vice presidential pick, so all the bounce he might have gotten out of putting that southerner on a ticket maybe was absorbed.
Well, Carl Lubsdorf, over the weekend, John Kerry was somewhat more specific about previous promises to reduce troop strength in Iraq, to have a plan, an exit strategy in Iraq. He said he'd substantially reduce troops by the end of his first term, but he wouldn't say more, prompting George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week program to accuse John Kerry of sounding like Richard Nixon and his secret plan to end the war in Vietnam, which resonated for a lot of people. Your thoughts on that?
Well, of course, Richard Nixon won the election in 1968. I think that John Kerry is being very careful not to be pinned down too specifically because events can overtake him very easily on this. And, I mean, there are already rumors about the Saudis trying to get more Arab troops into the area so that some U.S. troops can be brought home right before the election. But I think Andrea made a good point that with such a small number of undecided voters, this race has been pretty frozen. So that would be one reason why there wouldn't be much movement. Another is that some pollsters say that the matchup, the who you're going to vote for, is a lagging indicator, and that the underlying attitudes in which there was some good news for John Kerry here, you know, will eventually shape that vote. But the bottom line is that if in fact, Senator Kerry did not get a bounce out, and we'll know more when we see several other polls in the next couple of days, that's basically not good news for him. Because he needs to get a lead, because almost certainly President Bush will get some bounce out of his convention.
Well, and Andrea, what happens now? It seems to be a very delicate balance. We heard earlier in the program John Kerry being critical of President Bush, pointing out that we've just raised a terror alert. How far have we gotten in the war on terror? Again, I'm paraphrasing his thoughts. But how delicate a balance now in an election year when we have these, you know, hugely important to people, issues of terrorism?
I think they have to really walk a fine line. We saw that just yesterday, I believe. We had this terror alert here in Washington, New York, and in Newark. And Howard Dean, who, of course, was running for the president just a few months ago, came out and questioned the timing of it. You know, this is the third time, I believe, that the alert has gone up to orange. But this one's more localized than in the past. But one other time was when John Edwards was put on the ticket. So some Democrats are questioning the timing, but other Democrats, including John Kerry, are staying away because this is a very real threat.
And there is something, some would say, of a delicate balance for President Bush as well, and the White House and the Bush administration, Carl, because of that very reason. If they come forward with this timing, with this information, they may also be accused of politicizing it.
They had a good argument here, and that's that apparently an Al-Qaeda top operative was captured in recent weeks, and that a lot of this information comes from him, and they only just got it in the last few days. On the other hand, a lot of this information has to do with surveillance and has to do with a threat that has existed for 5 or 6 years, even before 9/11. So in a sense, they're coming to this a little bit late. So you can really argue this both ways. But the administration has a good case that this is new information.
Yeah. Well, something tells us all that this is not going to be a usual summer, not a summer of relaxing and kicking back. I want to thank you both.
My pleasure.
Glad to be with you, Robin.
Carl Lubsdorf, Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Andrea Stone, Washington reporter for USA Today. Still to come, the star of the irreverent sitcom Scrubs talks about Garden State, not New Jersey, but the movie he wrote, directed, and stars in. You're listening to Here and Now. China has launched a new campaign to encourage parents to value girls as highly as boys. This is a result of a growing disparity between the birth rates of boys and girls in China. Many parents choose to abort girl fetuses. China's 25-year-old population controls policies allows families to have only one child. Part of the new campaign has the government paying parents to have girl babies. David Glenn has written an analysis of the situation in the most recent issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. He joins us on the line. David, first, why are there so few girl babies born in China?
Well, this partly has to do with longstanding cultural beliefs that have gotten tied into actual social structures. For example, there is a strong social norm, especially outside of cities, that when you're elderly, you'll be taken care of by your sons. So if you reach the age of 60 or 70 and you only have daughters, you fear being neglected, thrown into poverty, and so on.
And in an article that you write, you include an old Chinese poem which talks about, you know, when a son is born, let him sleep on the bed, clothe him with fine clothes. When a daughter is born, let her sleep on the ground, wrap her in common wrappings. I mean, they've just not been valued.
That's right. And, of course, many cultures have had strong preferences for sons over the years, but it's really, you know, for a variety of reasons, only in China and other parts of Asia that those beliefs have really lingered and gotten bound up in concrete social practices.
Right, as such as encouraging people to have one child. And now paying people to have a girl baby?
Over the last 15 or 20 years, the government in China has taken a number of measures to try to discourage this very strong preference for sons and to discourage sex-selective abortions.
What are some of the fears of a society that has too many boys, too few girls?
Well, there's a new and controversial argument that two political scientists have been putting forward. Valerie Hudson of Brigham Young and Andrea Denbor, a British political scientist, have been arguing that a society that's skewed heavily toward men, especially young men, is prone to very high levels of crime, social disorder, and may even be prone to war.
So what are these people who are proponents of that theory saying is going to happen?
Well, when I interviewed one of these political scientists earlier this year, she said to me that in a worst case, she's afraid that as early as the year 2020, that the Chinese government might want to find some way to go to war with one of its neighbors simply in order to give these tens of millions of unmarried men something to do. That's one of the anxieties that some people believe the Chinese government has.
That's a pretty controversial concept.
Right. I also talked to a number of political scientists who are extremely skeptical of that kind of fear.
Yeah. But at the very least, is there a tie between just outright violence or crime and societies that have a preponderance of men?
Yes, there is. This is also somewhat controversial, but there is pretty strong evidence that when you have situations where there are high sex ratios, many more men than women, for example, on the American frontier in the 19th century, that that's an environment where you have a lot of violence and crime.
But there's also a fear that on a different level, there just won't be enough wives to go around.
Exactly. And these folks are arguing that if you have a population of tens of millions of men who are not only not married, but who know that they will probably never be married, that that's a recipe for, again, serious levels of crime, rebellion, and maybe even outright war.
Mm-hmm. David Glenn, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
David Glenn is a writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This check-in. Financial institutions identified as targets of a terrorist plot in New York, northern New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. are stepping up security, saying they won't be intimidated by the threats. In New York, police have sealed off some downtown streets and are banning trucks from bridges and tunnels leading to Wall Street. International finance employees in Washington are also going through additional security checks today. And in Newark, New Jersey, Prudential employees are being forced to wind through concrete barriers and security checks before entering their offices. But Treasury Secretary John Snow is reassuring investors, saying the nation's financial system is operating normally today. The new intelligence that sparked the warning does not give details about when or how terrorists might strike, but indicates they may favor car or truck bombs. This year's Sundance Film Festival saw an unusual partnership when the usually competitive Fox Searchlight Pictures and Miramax Films teamed up to buy distribution rights to a festival favorite, Garden State. Heralded as a graduate for today's 20-somethings, Garden State stars Zach Braff, the 29-year-old actor best known for his role as the overworked medical resident on the hit TV show Scrubs. But with Garden State, Braff shows he can also write and direct.
Garden State's about a guy who's been estranged from his family for about 10 years and comes home for the first time for his mother's funeral. While home over the 4 days that he's there, he is reunited with the friends he grew up with and meets a young lady played by Natalie Portman.
Zach's character in Garden State, Andrew Largeman, is a struggling television actor, and the film is based on Zach's own life and how his friends and family reacted after he found success in Hollywood.
I recognize you.
Oh, did you go to Columbia High?
No, not from high school, from TV. Didn't you play the retarded quarterback?
Yeah.
Are you really retarded?
No, I'm not.
Cool. Great job, man. I mean, I thought you were really retarded.
Here and Now producer Andrea Shea spoke with a young actor who now has Hollywood paying close attention to his turn as a director.
Yeah, well, I went to film school. This is, you know, when I set out first and foremost to be a filmmaker. It's what my dream was ever since I was a little kid. And then when I got out of school, I started auditioning in New York City for theater and independent films, and I started to have some beginner's luck. Over many years, that eventually led me to Scrubs. But as soon as I had an opportunity to, I had all these ideas for things I wanted to direct and do myself. So Scrubs gave me an opportunity to be able to show people what I wanted to do.
Ultimately, Garden State, it's a love story, but it's also about growing up. Main characters are facing the great abyss of life, I guess, because there's even an abyss in the film. Is that the point of the film? Like, what are you trying to say with this film?
I'm trying to say a lot of things, but for me, I really wanted to tell a story about what it felt like for me to be a 20-something in the year 2004. And the things I'm questioning, the things I'm thinking about, the loneliness and the melancholy that I felt. But I think everyone can relate to the feeling of feeling stuck and not really knowing how to move on. So the film's about that, but it's also about how short life is. And I wanted to tell a story about a guy who's long overdue to take charge of his life.
You know that point in your life when you realize the house you grew up in isn't really your home anymore? And all of a sudden, even though you have some place where you put it, that idea of home is gone.
Your character, Andrew, he's been on antidepressants forever, which is a very now kind of a thing. The story is very contemporary. The soundtrack's, you know, got a lot of young bands on it. There's modern details, like Peter Sarsgaard's character has Desert Storm trading cards.
Yeah.
But do you think that these characters, is this kind of a graduate for the Prozac generation?
Well, anytime you make a movie about someone who's young and lost, there's going to be graduate comparisons because that was obviously easily the most well-done movie of that ilk. But I don't know how you could be a 20-something in this day and age and not know plenty of people that are on some form of mental health pharmaceuticals. for a lot of good reasons. I think there's extraordinary medicines out there that are changing people's lives and saving a lot of people's lives. And it's just an interesting topic. And the book Brave New World always interested me, and there's a reference to it in the movie, but it feels like we're entering the Brave New World.
But we're talking about the film like it's pretty serious. At the same time, it's not, because it's a comedy.
Yeah, I guess what would be funny for your listeners to know at this point in the interview is it's a comedy. When I describe the tone to people, I say it's like American Beauty in some ways, in that the subject matter is very dark, but you've got a smile on your face the whole time. And it is, believe it or not, a comedy.
So now you wrote, directed, and starred in this film. Why did you decide to direct it also for your first big feature?
Well, if I had to choose any, I would have directed it only, because that's, again, what I wanted to do, what I dreamed of doing. Why I chose to also act in it was I felt like, first of all, I knew the character better than anyone I was going to be able to find. And secondly, I felt like if I hadn't written it, I never would have gotten a chance to play this part. It would have gotten offered to 10 other guys before I would have even gotten a chance to audition for it. And that happens so often in Hollywood, some of the scripts that when the great scripts come along, unless you're a huge star, you often don't even get a chance to campaign for them, because the biggest stars obviously have the pick of the litter. So I felt like, well, this is a really cool character piece, and I've got access to it, and there are people who are willing to let me do it. Why would I not, in the spirit of the movie, of going for it, you know, seizing the day, I felt like I should do it.
What was it like to do all those jobs at once for you? I mean, this is obviously a first.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's definitely patting your head and rubbing your belly at the same time.
I read that when you wrote the screenplay, you envisioned Natalie Portman in the role, and ultimately she ended up with the role. Her character is reminiscent of Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, and that she's kind of spastic and self-deprecating, but at the same time, she's really interesting.
Right.
And you starred in Manhattan Murder Mystery when you were 17.
Yeah.
Was this character inspired at all by Diane Keaton, and is the film inspired by Woody Allen at all?
Well, of course, he's one of my heroes, and Annie Hall, I think, is almost a perfect movie. I love Diane Keaton in that movie, and of course, that was an inspiration. I would even say more Ruth Gordon in Harold and Maude. I directed Natalie, I told her I wanted her to be a 21-year-old Ruth Gordon.
We're not going to make out or anything.
What?
I'm sorry. I just, like, totally ruined that moment, didn't I?
No, no.
It's just that, like, we're not going to make out, okay?
Oh, okay, no, I hadn't planned on trying.
Oh, my, I am so mean. I was, like, I'm sorry. I forget I just said that. That's dumb.
There's quite a cast, actually. A lot of stars from the New York stage are in this film. You have Dennis O'Hare from Assassins and Take Me Out, Jackie Hoffman from Hairspray, Ron Liebman, Angels in America, Sir Ian Holm from Homecoming and Lord of the Rings.
And let's not forget George Wolfe.
Oh, I was just about to get to George Wolfe, who directed Tony Kushner's Angels in America. Why did you turn to the stage for your actors in this film?
Well, that's how I began. George Wolfe gave me my first part at the Public Theater in a production of Macbeth. I was 8 years old and saw my father in a production of Prisoner's Second Avenue, because he did community theater. And I fell in love with the theater when I was a little kid. And so it was a chance for me to work with actors I really admired, you know, Dennis O'Hare and of course, George Wolfe, who's not first and foremost an actor, but did a wonderful job in a cameo he has. And the part was originally written as a French woman. I just couldn't find the right actress. And I woke up one day and I was like, well, what if it wasn't a French woman? What if it was George Wolfe? Just sort of randomly. And I called him and I said, this is a really random question, George, but will you play this character? And he's like, okay. And he came and did it.
So Fox Searchlight and Miramax came together to buy this film at Sundance.
Yes.
What was that like for you to be there with your first film and have these two big companies buzzing around and all the buzz generated?
You know, it's the young filmmaker's dream. You never imagine it's really going to happen like that. And I read lots of books about, you know, young filmmakers and going to Sundance. And little by little, it all happened. You know, I got the cell phone call from Harvey Weinstein, and I felt like, you know, he felt like you're dreaming, for lack of a better expression. And then in an unprecedented decision, they both decided to buy it together, which was wonderful to have two of the biggest and the best distribution companies releasing this little film I wrote in my boxers sitting at a dining room table in my apartment is beyond anything I could have imagined.
Era Now producer Andrea Shea speaking with writer, director, and actor Zach Braff about his new film, Garden State. A production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into radio and join us again, here and now.
I'm a white spy the window, vaguely looking down at her socks. And humming, possibly.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.